You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Do you ever wonder where some perfectly descriptive words or phrases originated? Words like serendipity or gobbledygook, or phrases like all hell broke loose or the earth moved? Well, Paul Dixon's new book, Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers, traces their origins. And although the usual suspects like Shakespeare are represented, the book also contains quite a few surprises. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it brings Paul Dixon to our show today. Hello.
Good to be back.
And let's begin with one I find kind of hard to believe. You say that Jane Austen invented the phrase baseball?
She did, or she's the first one to use it in literature. When she was writing Northanger Abbey, which was published in 1817, but she actually wrote the book in 1789. There's this one passage in which a young girl refuses to study, but she wants to be outside playing games, playing baseball. She actually uses the word baseball. And we found one other earlier use, but it really isn't. She's really the one that introduces it to literature. And we really aren't sure what she's talking about, but that's the first time it appears in literature.
It's obviously not the one that Abner Doubleday was involved with.
Right.
Or even cricket. Maybe it was an early version
of
cricket.
There were a lot of folk games that were based on bases, and there was a home in a lot of them.
Is this the most unlikely author of any given word or concept, or did you come up with a lot of big surprises?
There were just so many. I mean, a lot of them, even with the usual suspects. I think one of the most interesting things I found was the degree to which John Milton just created such. I mean, I think we would be tongue-tied if we had eliminated the words that he created. I mean, just some of my favorites: satanic, impassive, earth-shaking, lovelorn, horrent, infinitude, padlock, lovelorn, complacency, terrific.
Pandemonium,
which is his one great creation. I mean, he creates a place in Paradise Lost, which is actually sort of the hometown of the devils and demons. It's sort of like the Mount Olympus of evil. And he talks about pandemonium as a place. And that whole book is just remarkable for creating this sort of language of heaven and hell.
A number of those words rely on Greek or Latin.
Yes.
So was that a common thing to do at that time?
It was a common thing to do at that time, but some of them were also onomatopoetic. In other words, a lot of the words that Shakespeare and Milton are attributed. I mean, for a long time, they attributed the word puke to Shakespeare, P-U-K-E, meaning divine. Mm-hmm. And I think all the terms of regurgitation tend to be onomatopoetic. And a lot of the things that Shakespeare did, for example, either onomatopoetic or visual, one of the words he creates is fireworks. Before that, they're called pyrotechnics. Fireworks is just very much closer to the bone than pyrotechnics.
Well, we have to assume that the Milton's readers or Shakespeare's audiences understood those words. They couldn't have just invented words that would have gone above the audience's head. I'm not sure how many of them actually were invented by the authors, and or how many of them were in use, and Shakespeare or Milton or whoever were the first to write them down.
That's a brilliant point, because that's one of the points of the book, is that a lot of there have been many, many, many books written about how many words Shakespeare invented, sometimes into the thousands. And they'll attribute a word like something, my favorite is leapfrog. He uses it several times in plays. Well, he invented this world. That's probably absolutely untrue, because leapfrog was a word that was a children's game at the time, just hadn't been written down before Shakespeare, because if the audience in the Globe Theater was they wouldn't know what he was talking to, even if he's using it metaphorically. So a lot of the times these guys are listening, and I think one of the powers of Mark Twain is that a lot of the words that he's credited with, a lot of the words from, you know, Bonanza and Strike It Rich and the terminology, is really the terminology of the Gold Rush.
But Shakespeare is credited with giving us as much as 6,000 words. That obviously was easier for him to do than somebody today, because the language was still evolving. Even before him, we have Chaucer. Chaucer's credited with giving us the word bed.
Absolutely. And again, he may have heard it, or he may have taken it from a verb. It may have been to bed cattle for the evening. B-E-D, some very early Anglo-Saxon term. Shakespeare gets attributed with the word road. And I think what's...
Road, R-O-A-D?
Road, yeah. Just
nobody
hurry.
Said road before.
Well, you, what I think is the truth. There are many learned books which claim 1700, 2000, 2500. I worked with the head of the Shakespeare Guild of America and a couple really serious looks at what Shakespeare invented. He probably invented 500. Shakespeare's real contribution may be in the phrases "Wild Goose Chase," "As You Like It," "All's Well That Ends Well," "Brave New World."
And you have had this book published on the 450th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. So this is a kind of a tribute to the grand master of word and phrase creation.
Yes. On his quadra, sesquicentennial, the people at Merriam-Webster helped me come up with a word for 450th birthday. But again—
That's not going to catch on.
No, unless there's a 450th anniversary of something else.
Well, in the end, by the way, you attribute the word anchovy to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That's an odd word to have come up with.
He picks it up. There's just no such word and no such concept. And he does pick it up from a it's a derivation of a Portuguese word for small fish. But it becomes sort of central because anchovy paste in Dickens. There are more anchovies in Dickens than you can imagine.
I thought it was because of John Bon Jovi. No?
No. Or because of, you know what Billy Crystal said? Eating an anchovy is like eating an eyebrow.
There's an impressive list of Shakespearean words that are commonly used in sports lingo.
Yeah. Buzzer, manager, all those kind of things. And again, he brought life to the language. I think a lot of the life he brought to the language, just his ability to just say things simply, and also to change the position of words, like champion, making champion a verb.
Of course, he didn't have slam dunk or something like that. No, but you say making champion, so if champion would have been a description of somebody, we still use it as a noun.
Right.
And then he could say he championed, Shakespeare said he championed that cause.
Yes, and he also turned other words around. For example, scuffle was a noun, meaning a small fight, mm-hmm. and then he turned it into a verb.
He also did a lot of one-offs that didn't make
right.
it.
Yes, there are hundreds of those, and
those are the things that confuse us when we're watching a Shakespearean play, and somebody says something, and I get the gist, although I have no idea what was just being
right.
said.
And John Andrews is that is Shakespeare Guild has written this wonderful paper that some of them were printer's errors as they went from folio to folio. They sometimes made a mistake, and the word is now passed down to us. But friending is a nice one. That appears
he said friending?
In Hamlet. Yeah, he said friendling
God.
In Hamlet.
So way before Facebook.
Yes, way before Facebook. And, of course, Yahoo is from, of course, that's from Gulliver's Travels. That's from Swift. And Twitter, of course, first shows up in Tom Jones, Fielding's book.
Twitter does?
Yeah, yeah.
In what context?
Context of meaningless sort of babble. Mm-hmm. Just twittering too.
Well, that describes most
twittering
of
fools, you know. So,
One of the big surprises to me was Chaucer. We're going all over the place here.
Yeah, yeah.
But he came up with the word universe.
Yeah.
You got to have to wonder what were people saying before then.
They probably weren't thinking that way. The same reasons. One of the ones that Milton creates this in the same exact vein. Is Milton comes up with the current concept of space, not the distance between somebody else at the table, but the concept of outer space of a realm above the earth.
And then I was sad to hear he'd beaten Oprah to the aha in, as we say, the aha
moment. Yes.
How did he use aha?
In the same way, a moment of aha, you know, of because I think when you hear something like aha, it's onomatopoetic again. It's sort of, I got it, you know.
My guest is Paul Dixon, whose latest book is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. Where does the word authorism come from? Is that one of yours?
It's one of mine. I made that up for the purpose of a book. And I have a couple that, I've been writing for many, many years. And I have a couple that I'm credited with in the Oxford English Dictionary, which I didn't invent. The Oxford English Dictionary claims that I was the first person to use the word water pick as a verb.
Right.
I am working on one word that has been accepted is I have a there's a thing in English called a contrastive focus reduplication, which has been a term that's been around for a long, long time for when you repeat a word to differentiate it from something else. Like you say grass, grass as opposed to grass. Are you talking about grass, or you're talking about grass? I mean, that kind of thing. Or, you know, and it goes on book versus mail versus email kind of thing. And that phenomenon is called contrast. And I have to look down at my notes every time because it's so complicated. Contrastic focus reduplication. Well, I replace that with the words word, for that phenomenon. And that's now in the Oxford Companion to English Literature. So I've knocked out contrastive focus reduplication.
Some of these things just are become successes by accident. I'm sure that Hemingway wasn't thinking of creating a phrase that would be used by people to describe a certain physical reaction when he wrote "The Earth Moved."
But every college kid for 2-3 generations know, you know, that when they heard that term, they knew what he was talking about, and that's a funny way. And the funny thing also is a lot of writers will try to get words adopted. Sinclair Lewis, for example, I did some research, and he would write to Merriam-Webster Dictionary with words that he wanted in the dictionary. And one was philanthrober, which was for sort of philanthropist Robert Barron. And another one was teetotalitarian for the forces of prohibition.
Well, I think Conrad Aiken wanted us to use smubble teas. Calvin Trillin really fought hard to get us to say Sabbath gas bags. To talk about the people who go on the Sunday morning or Saturday morning talk shows. Those didn't catch on much despite their campaigns.
I think Trillin's a great case because Trillin is, if you go again to the Oxford English Dictionary, which lists the first use and by implication the coinage, Trillin gets wonky. He gets credit for WNKY, meaning, you know, sort of a policy wonk kind of thing. And he gets, because of Alice Let's Eat, which is one of my favorite books of all time, Buffalo Chicken Wings. And I would imagine he probably would deny it. He probably picked it up. But again, so Sabbath Gas Bag, I know he worked long and hard for that. And we're helping him today with Sabbath Gas Bags.
You mentioned Dickens coming up with, not Dickens, Mark Twain coming up with Struck It Rich, Petered Out, Bonanza, also squeal, I guess. Yeah. And then Dickens had a whole bunch of words. Is that the reason they were so influential is simply because they were so popular?
No, but when it was, I think both those guys would – actually, Twain actually said, I invented virtually no words. And the big –
But he had a good ear.
Right. He called them second strikes as opposed to coinage, if you want to use the mint kind of analogy. But Twain said what I had. He said the greatest source of language were the gold mines of Nevada and California and the Mississippi River. So he picks up all this language. And Dickens does the same thing. Dickens marches through the slums of London and Paris. I mean, the reason he knows about the Artful Dodger and about the criminal class and the pickpockets of London is that both these guys had great ears and they put themselves out away from their desks into these into this milieu where they would hear the words from Old Bailey, the criminals testifying, or they would hear the prostitutes at the mining camps. They would hear this stuff, and then they would work that into their language.
Some of the inventors of words are not surprises, like Isaac Asimov coming up with microcomputer. Mm-hmm. But one of the biggest surprises to me was the attribution of the phrase mental masturbation.
That one actually threw me off that one threw me out of bed, that one myself, because that was just such a – and it's Lord Byron, and he creates this vivid metaphor, which is we still have, to John – it's describing John Keats. He writes to his editor, and do you want me to read the quote there in which he used it? He said, such writing is – again, talking about the poet Keats. Such writing is sort of mental masturbation. He was always frigging his imagination. I don't mean that he is independently but viciously soliciting his own ideas into a state which is neither poetry nor anything else but a bedlam, a vision produced by raw pork and opium.
I mean, that was mean. And Keats is, he was wrong. Keats is a pretty great poet.
I know, but also, did you see how many, I mean,
yes.
How many
images? He didn't come up with the word bedlam.
Yeah. So that is true. But just to watch those things go through their mind. I mean, the other thing that's it was really interesting to me in doing this book were the people, the Americans, like James Fenimore Cooper, who with some degree of respect basically creates a language for the American Indian. So when he's trying to interpret their concept of an afterlife, he comes up with happy hunting ground. I mean, he sees these terms that sort of pop out of their lives.
Who came up with portmanteau?
That was Lewis Carroll. And again, here's a guy who created his, you know, has created this world of Tugly and all these different
Brillig and
Slithy Tubbs, and they're all sort of, a lot of them are combination words, which we, the portmanteau word, which is where you smash two words together so you can carry them around like a suitcase. Then we ended up with smog and all the rest, which are portmanteau.
And then there are other cases where authors had words that became, were used by others. James Joyce coming up with a word like quark.
Yeah. I mean, that's all over the place. That business where the word that one writer comes up with gets passed along. And then the other case that just fascinated me is the ones where they don't really intend to without creating a character. I mean, you go back to Sinclair Lewis, all this work he gets to work, get his words like Kiplingo, that was another one he created. And then what happens is Babbitt becomes a word. Mm-hmm. And the other one that he created was Shotgun Marriage, Shotgun Wedding. That was Sinclair Lewis. But Babbitt, he was a little bit, you know, he had really worked to get these other words in the book. And then, you know, Babbitt, which is, you know, I think he described as a man who would sell his morals and his principles for a new Buick, gets into the book.
Well, he created a character who we recognize,
sure,
and then could apply that name to an awful lot of people, unfortunately, I've met in my lifetime.
Sure, and there's Scrooges and Romeos out there, too.
Yes. And there's a Paul Dixon whose latest book is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. It is published by Bloomsbury, and there are lots more, lots of really interesting things in this book. Obviously, we couldn't get to all 100 and how many pages is it? 225 pages. So this is a delight to read, and thank you, Paul, so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much, Leonard.